I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show's about pets. More specifically, our relationships with pets and what pets actually do to us. I was driving here to the radio station a couple of months ago, and I was behind a car, and there was a paw print on the car. And it said, "I don't know who rescued who." And that's the gist of today's show. What we do for them, what they do for us, and how they can really change lives and do very often. And we're going to hear details of that. Our first guest is Sharon Kahn Luttrell. She's the author of Weekends with Daisy and a volunteer weekend puppy raiser with a program called NEEDS. It's an organization training service dogs for deaf and disabled Americans in Massachusetts. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
By the way, not only was your book great, it was so well written.
Thank you so much.
Highly recommend it. In our second part of our show, Sharon will be joining us, continuing with us, we've got Michelle Peach. She's a grief counselor at the University of Pennsylvania. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We all have our pet stories and what pets have done for us, and maybe you've got some insight into how they've done it. 888-477-9499. And please, tweet us a picture of your pet. We're at Voices in the Fam. So, Sharon, Weekends with Daisy. Daisy was your dog. I'm more interested to begin with, not how she entered your life just yet, but when. What was going on in your life at that moment?
Well, it was an interesting time of my life, one that I really was not prepared for. I was 46, and my children were 11 and 15. A couple of years earlier, our dog, who we had had for almost 15 years, had died. And I really wanted another dog in my life, but I didn't want to go through that whole process of seeing a dog grow old and die. So we would do things like take in our friends' dogs. I would see a dog on the street. I would slow down. I was suffering from what I had decided was canine deficit disorder.
I love that language. I love it. It's going to be in the next DSM, and there'll be medication for it. Yeah, it's happening. I'm sorry, go on.
So at the same time that I was craving the presence of a dog in my life, at the same time I was struggling with what I realized later on was a loss of my identity as a mother of small children.
Mm-hmm.
My kids were growing older. They didn't need me as much. I apparently had my entire social structure depended on them. So as they were sort of fading away, growing up, fading away out of my life, all of my interactions with other adults were sort of falling away as well, because they all centered around my kids' lives, my kids' activities. So,
there was a big hole there for you.
There was a big hole, and I was not prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for this next stage of my life. I didn't even realize I was entering the next stage until I was sort of in it, flailing around.
So. There you are in the midst of all of these emotions and sense of loss and emptiness. And like many life-altering events, yours took place in the grocery store, specifically between the pickles and the olives on Mother's Day. So and that's everybody's story, isn't it? My life changed between the pickles and the olives.
Exactly. We don't know when it will happen. And I think what's important is to be open to it and to recognize it when it does happen. We're coming back from visiting my mother-in-law and father-in-law, and they're gone now. At the time, their lives were winding down, and it was becoming so clear that we wouldn't have them with us that much longer. So there were a lot of emotions happening. I was with both of my children and my husband, which was so rare that the four of us would be together. And I was in between the pickles and the olives when I saw a little yellow lab wearing a blue coat that said puppy in training. And
so what happened to Sharon?
I followed that dog. I followed that dog all the way to the checkout line. Well, my daughter pretended she didn't know me.
Yeah, of course. it is a little weird. I mean, it's like a puppy stalker, you know.
Well, I've been on the other end of that now for a few years, so it's more common than you'd think. So I followed this dog who was with a man who told me that he was a weekend puppy raiser for this organization called NEEDS, Dogs for Deaf and Disabled Americans, which is a nonprofit that trains and places service dogs with people who have disabilities. And I learned all about the program, and I thought, this is it. I can have a dog. I can have a dog every weekend, and the dog will never grow old and never die. And when I'm done, after a year or so of helping train this dog, I will get a new puppy, and it will just continue on into infinity, and I'll never have to deal with the loss of a dog again.
Right. You sound like a grandparent.
So, I kind of feel like a grandparent when the dogs go off with their new people, and I'm grandma. Sometimes I get to watch them.
Yeah. So I want to know about Daisy and how she entered your life, and what impact did it have on you, knowing that this intimate, loving relationship, I'm sure, knowing you and most humans with dogs, it turns into a loving relationship. What's it like being in this loving relationship, knowing that it's very temporary?
I didn't confront that it was temporary, not in any real honest way. I kind of let every weekend stand on its own, and I think maybe in a way it's how we go about life, right? We just kind of, we deal with what's in front of us at the time. And I fell so deeply in love with Daisy. I couldn't imagine her not being with me. Mm. So I just put that right out of my mind.
Let me reintroduce you, because I want to talk about what happens next with her in this training. You're listening to Sharon Kahn Luttrell. She's written Weekends with Daisy, and we're talking about the relationship between our animals here. We're talking specifically about dogs and us, and what they do to us and what they do for us. Later on, we'll hear from Michelle Peach. Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. We want to hear your stories about your relationship with your pets, what they have done for you, and what is that relationship like? Again, that's 888-477-9499. So take us the next step. So you were in denial with Daisy. So mm-hmm. and you were the weekend mom. So
yes.
Well, what did Daisy do during the week?
Daisy during the week lived in a medium security prison with a inmate who I call Keith in the book, and his job in prison was to train her to be a service dog. Most of NEEDS, about 90-95% of the puppies that NEEDS trains are actually trained by prison inmates who have the dogs Monday through Friday, and they teach them basic obedience, and then as the dogs get older, they teach them all of the tasks that they'll need to know as service dogs. So they learn how to open and close doors, retrieve objects, turn on and off light switches, that sort of thing.
Who trains the prisoners to train the dogs?
Well, the prisoners are trained by a trainer from NEEDS. So there are, in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, there are 10 prisons that have puppies, NEEDS puppies. Each one of those prisons has a trainer from NEEDS who goes in once a week and works with the inmate they call them the dog handlers, the inmates, the inmate dog handlers. And they have a class. They learn how to care for the dog, and they learn the training, and they sort of troubleshoot any problems that they're having. They get the support of, you know, of a trained trainer, a professional trainer. But they themselves, they become so skilled at what they do. It's amazing to see them work with these puppies and turn them from these unruly little dogs into perfectly trained service dogs. It's just phenomenal.
You might not know this, Sharon, but like, what are they taught? What techniques are they taught? Do you know?
Well, the inmates, I guess, from the very beginning, the first thing that they need to do, or the first thing that they do, is they spend 2 weeks of uninterrupted time with their new puppy. So the inmates will start off in the program. And let me back up a bit. In order to get into the program, they have to be model inmates. They can't have any infractions against them. And they apply for the job. First, they have to be recommended. They have to be referred into the program by a counselor or a correctional officer. They're interviewed for the job. And then if they're hired or accepted into the program, they are placed as a backup handler. So they get to work closely with another inmate who's the primary handler and kind of learn the ropes. And once they've learned the ropes, they get their own puppy. So they'll get a puppy at about 12 weeks. They spend 2 weeks of uninterrupted time with that dog so they can bond. They teach the dog, the first thing they teach the dog is to love his name. So they'll say, like with Daisy, Keith would call Daisy. And when she looked at him, because eye contact is so important in a service dog, he would celebrate it. You know, he would give her treats and praise her. So they form, the two of them form a pretty tight bond. Then they'll start, I'm sorry.
I'm curious about the mechanical part, Sharon. Dogs have to be taken out, you know.
Oh, I know. That was one of my first questions, too. I couldn't imagine how they ever took the dogs out to go to the bathroom. But what they do is they have access to the yard, and they have time outside to take the dogs out. So the inmates who are in the program, at least the program in the prison where Daisy was, they would get let out before anybody else first thing in the morning. And then they would get one last chance at night. And the ones with the younger puppies, 6 months and under, were able to, I think up until 10 o'clock at night, they could turn on their cell light to signal the officer in charge that their dog needed to go out one last time before settling in for the night. And that's not to say there weren't accidents. They all have cleanup supplies in their cells. The dogs live in the cells with them, in a kennel, in a crate. So, it's not ideal, but it works really well for giving the dogs 24-hour personal training, and they learn quickly, and they learn efficiently in a way that's just not possible if you have, you know, a professional trainer at needs or at the facility.
All right, this sounds great so far. Tell us what happens to the prisoners.
Well, it's kind of neat because I've never worked with the women inmates, so I can't talk about that. But I have seen the men with their puppies, and it's so touching to see these prison inmates in their uniforms and in prison. It's all about really kind of being tough and giving the appearance of not allowing anybody to mess with you and not ever looking soft, right? So when they're with the puppies, they're gentle, they're patient, they're consistent, they're fun and funny. It's all positive training. There is no negative. There's no negativity in the training. It's not allowed, and that's not what the inmates are taught. They're taught to use positive reinforcement. So there's a lot of praising, lots of cuddling, lots of love and affection.
So what do you think happens to the prisoners? What's your theory?
I've talked with some of them about what happens to them and how they change when they're given a dog. And there are guys in there who have never taken care of another being in their lives. Keith, I have to say, never took care of himself because when he was incarcerated, he was 16, so he had no experience. When he got his first puppy, he learned to nurture another being. He learned to respond to another, to this puppy's needs, and to be patient with Daisy and consistent, and it taught him about himself and what he's capable of.
He's capable of loving.
He's capable of loving. He's capable of taking care of another, of developing empathy. He realized he had empathy. I think with him, for him it wasn't such a stretch. There were some other inmates who were really hardened, very hardened, who when they got the puppies found emotions in themselves that they didn't know existed. There's one man who, he was 59 years old when I met him, when I talked with him, and he had been in the system since he was 14, starting with, juvenile, they call it the school for boys, I think. So he was this 59-year-old man who had been in the prison system for all of those years, maybe a year or two out, but mostly incarcerated. When he got his first puppy, he said he experienced emotions that he didn't know existed in himself, but he recognizes what had been missing in his own life. And he kind of promised to the puppy that he would give this part of himself to the puppy. So it would be, the dog would basically thrive in a way that he didn't as a child.
You know, Sharon, we now know, we can look at this neurologically, we can look at it emotionally and spiritually, but this business of love, it really doesn't matter whether we're giving it or receiving it. Love is love, you know, and it's got the same healing powers, no matter which direction it goes in. St. John the Baptist said, where there is no love, put love, and then there will be love. So, you know, we know that love heals.
So, oh, yeah.
So that's...
And love from a pup, for love from a dog is just as valid as, and easier, I think, than love from a human, another human being.
Sure, sure. And, you know, it's taking care of a tiny little vulnerable thing that can't express its own needs. So, you know,
right.
It brings up all sorts of tender feelings. Sharon, I've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk much more about this program. We'll bring in Michelle Peach, who's a grief counselor at University of Pennsylvania, and we'll begin taking your calls. We're talking about our relationship with our animals, what they do for us, and what they do for others. We've got more stories to tell you about this prison populations, dogs that are working with vets and PTSD. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And we'd love to see a picture of your pet. Tweet it to us at Voices in the Fam. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it to you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco.
Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning wherever you are when you tune in tomorrow for Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for NPR's Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about these pets of ours that we love so dearly, what they do for us, literally, and what they can do for other populations. As I mentioned before the break, Sharon is continuing to join us. Sharon Conn-Luttrell is the author of Weekends with Daisy, and Michelle Peach is with us now. She's a grief counselor at the University of Pennsylvania. Michelle, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So did you get a chance to listen to the first part of the show?
Yes, absolutely. It's really fantastic to hear, so many different aspects of the benefits of the human-animal bond, and to also hear, from another side of it as well. I have some experience with some of the prison dogs too, so it's really nice to hear somebody else who also has been able to experience that side and really characterize it so well.
The program you're involved with prison dogs is a bit different than the one Sharon just described.
Right. Yes, the one I'm involved with is actually New Leash on Life USA, and they start out, the dogs that they bring into the program actually are all at-risk dogs from shelters who are chosen, based on being on the euthanasia list, whether they need some extra training or they just have had a difficult start or there's just not space in the shelter. And they bring them in, and there's sort of two different parts of the program. They, either come in and go to one of the prisons where they spend 12 weeks being trained by inmates. They live right in the cells with them. They're trained to pass their Canine Good Citizen certification, which they actually have 100% success rate in passing that, which makes them a lot more adoptable coming out.
Wait a minute. Good Citizen?
Canine Good Citizen Certification. It basically is, a test that shows that these are animals that would be good in a home. They have been able to sit and stay and listen to commands and really reducing the likelihood that they would be returned or cause other problems going forward. And oftentimes that Canine Good Citizen Certification is the first step towards becoming a therapy dog. Oftentimes the therapy dog organizations require a dog to have passed the Canine Good Citizen certification, as with our Vet Pets program at Penn Vet.
I'm going to stop you for a minute. I've been asking our listeners to call in with their pet stories, and I've been hogging the show for half of it. Let's go right to the phones. We'll bring in some of our callers. We've got Katie on the line. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
I'm
calling because my current dog has really helped me through a bad situation. I lived in Illinois, didn't have very many friends because my husband had actually moved there from Delaware, and I went with him. And he was working, I wasn't. I had fibromyalgia, I had depression. I had an older dog who I visited my daughter in West Virginia, and she said, "This dog has to be put down. She started being mean." And so we did, and right after that, I had dog need. I had that same thing that the earlier woman had.
Canine deficit disorder, yeah.
So I got a pet finder and found a shelter on the way home that had a litter of puppies, went out of my way about 200 miles, got this little black puppy who was just exactly what I needed. This puppy to whom everything was a game, full of love, but full of lots and lots of challenges for me. And he still is, and I've gotten through everything, and I'm on a good path now, and I really have to credit him for a lot of that.
Oh, isn't that great? And so the dog turned you around to what path are you on now?
Pardon?
You say you're on a different path. What happened?
Well, I've gotten through the divorce. I moved back to Delaware. I now have two dogs and a cat, all from shelters.
What's the black dog's name?
Kaz, for Tasmanian Devil.
I had a black cocker spaniel named Aldo, who was he wasn't very bright, and that's putting it kindly. But he was the sweetest, most loving dog. Still miss him. So thanks so much.
Oh yeah.
Thanks so much for your call.
You miss him, but there's another one, and each dog is different and gives you something different.
Yeah, they sure do. Thanks so much for your call, Katie. And speaking of each dog giving you something different, Sharon, are you still there? I want to come back to you, and we talked about how difficult it was. Well, you suggested it was difficult for you with Daisy when she finally left you. You've been a weekend mom to a lot of dogs since then. Does your relationship with them change over time? Do you grieve or not grieve?
It does change over time. Well, let me put it this way. It's become a little bit easier with each dog than it was with Daisy to say goodbye. And the reason why I know now is because I saw the whole cycle. She went to a boy who needed her, and that allowed me to sort of step back and with each dog after her and kind of internalize that this is not my dog, and this I'm just helping this dog become somebody else's dog, and for that reason it's become easier. Although I do have to say I'm on number 11 now. Not all have successfully gone through the program. Four are now working service dogs.
You've got seven flunkouts.
I have seven flunkouts now, yes. but I have to say that the one I'm with now, Samurai, I'm kind of thinking of him as my dog, but I know that as he gets closer to graduating, that will, I'll be able to let go a little bit. I know I will.
I want to turn back to you, Sharon, and the issue of grief, which is what we're talking about. Michelle talked about Sharon talked about grief, Michelle, when her beloved dog died, and we hear stories about grief all the time, and I spoke about my grief in the billboard. Tell me about your program and what's offered.
Well, that's exactly what we were thinking of, what PennVet had in mind when creating the Veterinary Grief Support Program. I offer a variety of services. I do two support groups. So one is the Pet Grief Loss Support Group, which is once a month. And then in addition, I also do what I call Cleo's Caregivers Group, which was named after a dog that I had raised for 15 years who eventually came down with lymphoma and went through about 2 years of chemotherapy, and during that time there were issues of anticipatory grief and talking with a lot of other pet owners that were in that same type of place, feeling that they knew their dogs wouldn't be with them forever. They wanted to cherish every moment they had with them, but they were starting to go through some of those same stages of grief that individuals would go through if they have lost or are about to lose a human family member. Mm-hmm. But the difference was with it being a pet, although the feelings were just as strong, oftentimes society looks at this differently. So a lot of, you know, the pet lovers and pet owners really felt that they didn't have somewhere to turn to be able to talk about it because they had this experience of disenfranchised grief, that it was something they couldn't express to society. So that's sort of how the Cleo's Caregivers group spawned, you know, for folks whose pets were still alive, but maybe, you know, getting closer to that point. And I additionally run, you know, I do individual counseling with people. I do family counseling. Sometimes there's issues where, you know, the parents are heartbroken over the loss of a pet. And also, so they're trying to put on a strong face to be there for their children, but they're also grieving themselves and don't know how to have those tough conversations. Or sometimes you have one spouse that feels one way about that it's time to euthanize, and then the other spouse might feel differently, that, you know, they're not quite ready yet. So sometimes I come in during that process as well.
That's a big deal that humans don't have to deal with, and that's, you know, deciding that it's time. That's a, you know, it's a very painful. I've been there with three pets. It's so painful, and three pets and one with my daughter. I mean, that's agony making that decision. My daughter, fortunately, is a veterinary nurse and really has a deep love for dogs and cats, for all animals. And, like, she knows. I mean, she knows. She doesn't want an animal she loves to suffer. But, I mean, regular people, I mean, how do we do that and how do we live with it?
Right. Well, that's, I mean, I think that's a very good question, that it is, you know, you raised a really important point that this is not something that we think about in human medicine. So it's very unique to, you know, a pet owner to have to actually make these life and death type of decisions about, you know, it being time and when it's time, and actually having the option to be there during the process or choosing not to. And, you know, the way that I try to talk about it with my clients are, you know, I kind of relate it back to that human-animal bond, because I know that that's what this segment is about today, and this is really an aspect that comes in every part of that relationship with an animal. So from the time you first fall in love with that puppy or kitten, you know, throughout their lives making medical decisions to, unfortunately, at the end when you're having to make these type of life and death decisions. And if you relate it back to that human-animal bond, sometimes it's give and take. It's really meant to be this mutually beneficial relationship between the two parties. And, you know, sometimes that means that you have to take one for the team. Sometimes that means they're taking one for the team by being that emotional support for us. So when we're getting to that point of having to make some of these really tough decisions, if people can kind of look at it as, you know, saying, okay, well, this is not an easy decision. This may be one of the toughest decisions I ever have to make in my life.
And it's an act of love, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. It absolutely is. It's basically being completely selfless in that, in saying that I'm willing to take on this extra emotional pain by making this decision to save my animal companion from having to feel the physical pain of having to go forward with it.
Making decisions out of love are sometimes very, very painful. Listen, Sharon and Michelle, we've got to take a very short break, and when we come back, we're going to be taking many more calls, and I want to hear more about these programs, and especially Michelle's program about where the dogs work with vets with PTSD. We're talking about our relationship with our pets and what they do for us and what they do for others. Our number is 888-477-9499. And you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and boarding options is dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole. Taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering campus tours on March 25th and April 29th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about our relationships with our pets. We're speaking with Michelle Peace. She's a grief counselor at U of P Veterinary Hospital. And Sharon Kahn Luttrell, among other things she does. She's the author of a terrific book called Weekends with Daisy. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear your stories. And please, tweet us a picture of your pet at Voices in the Fam. I told my producer we would show those pictures on next week's radio show. It took her a second to get it. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Tim on the line. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi. What can we do for you? What's your story?
I'm enjoying this conversation very much. I have a soon-to-be two-year-old Labrador Retriever who is just the most loving, dumb beast ever. But my wife and I were in a situation where our youngest child graduated high school, and we were empty nesters with the world at our leisure, and we decided to get a puppy. And I don't know what kind of void we were trying to fill, but we now have a lifelong toddler that we love dearly. And,
yes.
And we've put two cats down over the course of the last 6 years, and it's been devastating. The thought of losing a dog, while it's the same kind of beast, it seems to be much more part of our nuclear family than the aloof Abyssinians were.
Oh, Tim, many would argue that, you know, cats are right there. They're, you know, they're very intelligent, and they can be loving on occasion when they give you permission.
Oh, ours were, and they yeah. were like lap dogs. The one Abby followed me around everywhere I went all the time, and it was wonderful, and it was devastating to have to put her down.
It's just a wonderful story. How long did it take you to recover, or have you recovered?
Oh, I haven't recovered yet. We put our first Abby down, and we went rescued another one, and about 5 years, we had to put her down for other medical reasons, and it's like losing a family member. I mean, the entire process. And you mentioned something earlier about being an active participant in the dying process, and that's very difficult. We as a family went in, and we as a family grieved.
Yeah, death is problematic. And it's problematic because we love, you know, we love
Absolutely.
Deeply. We love those who die, and it's problematic for us because we love life. You know, that's what makes death problematic. Tim, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you for letting
for
me
your
speak.
Call.
Have
sure,
a good day.
Sure. Sharon, whenever I, you know, when I look through your book and when I research this, I find amazing stories of, you know, these animals and the relationship that works between dogs and prisoners. What about the bad news? I'm sure not every dog and inmate wind up with great stories.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there are bad, there are not so successful stories. Not every dog makes it. Not every dog has it within him or herself to be a service dog. Those dogs are adopted out as what Needs calls fabulous. I'm sorry, they used to call them fabulous flunkies, but they felt that was too derogatory. So now they call them furloughed favorites. and they make wonderful pets. They may flunk because they, they bark at shopping carts in the store. So that won't be a problem if you have one of these dogs as a pet because they won't be seeing shopping carts to bark at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but they do, these dogs really do. I love Tim, I guess it was. I love his characterization of his lab as being a lifelong toddler now that they have, he and his wife have, because that's what these dogs are. They're just so full of, they're like children. They're like, you know, they're so playful, and it's nice to get lost in that as a human.
Yeah. Speaking of that, he also, and I want to turn to you, Michelle, with this. He also mentioned that his beloved dog was not very bright. And my daughter, the one I just spoke about, had a pit bull mix, a three-legged pit bull mix who was filled with energy and really, really, really smart and was a bit out of control. So she took this dog to an animal behaviorist, not inexpensive, and the behaviorist said she has never had to work with a dumb dog. All the dogs she works with are smart dogs. So, you know, that's helpful to know.
Often it's about finding what their motivation is. That, you know, the same way with with people, you know, dogs are motivated by different things as well and have a drive for different things. So some might be suited for different jobs than others. Some might be food motivated. Some might be treat motivated. So that's really about kind of getting to know that individual and sort of working from, you know, what they have to offer and what drives them as as a unique being.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Justice on the line. Justice.
Hello.
Hi, Justice.
Hello. Is this for me?
Yep.
Hi, it's Linda.
Oh, Linda.
Yeah, Linda Justice, but I like the Justice part.
Yeah.
You were talking about service dogs. I have a guide dog and have had several. One area that's not always talked about when we get into the grieving thing is what it's like for someone who has a service dog that has to be put down because of age or illness. When you have a dog with you 24/7 practically, and the dog goes everywhere you go, I mean, the bonding, the loving is just beyond belief. And it's good to know that you folks are out there, because we don't really have, you know, we try to contact our school, but they don't get into the grieving process as much because they're too busy hoping, getting other dogs ready. And so I tuned in a little bit late, but every time folks talk about pets and so forth, I don't hear much about service animals being mentioned as much. I lost my lab. Zachary with laryngeal paralysis last May, but the way I kind of, I mean, I still grieve over him, but I have a new dog now, and he's a yellow lab named Calypso, and you know, getting a new dog and going through all the training and all that did help a lot, and I love him very, very much. But this is my fifth dog, and it's just hard. You wonder if he can go through another time. You know, they do get old. They do get ill or things happen. My husband's current guide is 11, and he or almost 11, and he has arthritis, you know. So these are things that we go through, but we still love our dogs. And I want to thank you folks for being there, and we'll try to obtain more information about you.
Well, wait one second. You don't have to try to obtain. Michelle, make your pitch.
Yes. Well, actually, that is definitely something that, you know, we address through Penn Vet's, you know, veterinary grief support program as well, that I get a number of calls from people that have, whether they're a police officer and they've lost their canine partner, whether they are an individual with a service dog that they have, you know, unfortunately had to say goodbye to their service dog. And while it's certainly a different experience, and some might say that bond that, you know, you have with a service dog is even deeper than that of, you know, a normal sure. human-animal bond, you know, pet situation, because you're truly relying on each other for, you know, a variety of different aspects, whether it's emotional support or physiological support, physical support, mental support, you know, a variety of different things that it's important to really acknowledge that loss and to reach out for support as well and make sure you have someone to talk to through that process, and also understand that while you would probably get, you know, another dog, you know, after losing a service dog, it doesn't mean that that bond is going to be the same right away. And you can, and it's okay to love each one, but to love them differently. That, you know, one is not going to replace the other. Maybe it will in certain physical aspects, but it's going to take time for you to create that bond with the new dog as well, and that doesn't replace what you've had with the previous dog.
And Justice, I hope that's great advice and counsel for you. Michelle, you teach the human-animal bond to veterans,
yes.
you know, to veterinarians. And
yes.
you know, at first glance, I mean, that seems like telling Noah about the flood. I mean, theoretically, why do they need that?
Well, actually, it's for the veterinary doctoral students at UPenn. It's an optional class that they can take, and actually we've been teaching it since 2010. I teach it alongside Dr. Cindy Otto, and, you know, it's something that we really started. It actually spawned from running the Vet Pets Therapy Dog program through the Penn Vet, and where we bring our therapy dogs up to the Ronald McDonald House every week and visit with children that have cancer and have had a variety of illnesses and surgeries, and a lot of our students, despite their crazy busy schedules, you know, always made time to bring their dogs up and, you know, and to just see this incredible benefit, that it was almost tangible what was going on between, you know, these children that are finally able to feel like kids and you know, just, you know, do normal things that kids would regularly do. They miss their home, their pets at home.
Sure.
And, you know, so, you know, and also the volunteers there and the families there. And it was something that our students have talked about, that was the best part of their week. No matter how many exams they had or how much
yeah.
to study for, it was so worth going. And we wanted something that we can sort of expand this and find a way to give them credit, really, for it. So it was something that kind of started from that program and then has expanded beyond that, that we realized that we could tap into so many aspects of the human-animal bond and have a lot of guest speakers.
Wonderful program, and what wonderful insight. It's like, you know, I said in the introduction, you know, that paw print on the car, who rescued who, you know,
right.
it's you know, I've got a buddy who's a judge, and he's got a very, very busy schedule, and he says the highlight of his week is reading to kids and kindergarten kids in Camden, so, and that's
yeah.
the highlight of his week. I want to switch back to Sharon, if I may. I really want to talk to you about the last dog you fostered and what happened.
The last dog that I had, his name is Rescue, and it's funny that you mention that, because Rescue spent this morning in U.S. District Court in Boston while his person, Jess, testified in the Boston Marathon bombing trial. Jess and her husband, Patrick, they both lost a leg at the Boston Marathon in 2013 when the bombs went off. Need started a program called Positively Strong, and they provide service dogs for victims of the Boston Marathon bombing who suffered a permanent physical injury. I guess Needs felt like everybody else when the bombs went off, is that we needed to do something.
Mm-hmm.
They needed to do something. We all felt like we needed to do something. So we were puppy raising Rescue at that time, and the marathon is a family tradition for us. My brother flies in from LA every year to run it, and in 2013, my son Josh was 15 at the time, and he taped his name onto his chest, and he jumped into the race and ran for a few miles alongside his uncle. So it was a really amazing day for him. And then, you know, and then the bombs went off, and it everything flipped.
So there was nothing that I, as his mother, could say to him about what had happened, and other than the people were trying to help, people were running toward the explosions, and you know, we donated to the one fund and did what we could. And in September of that year, we found out that one of the victims, Jess, was getting rescued, the dog that we had been puppy raising. Mm. So that changed our memories of that day. And I see Jess has been quoted as saying that when she got rescue, that was the first time that she had slept through the night. Mm. since the bombings.
Boy, talk about PTSD cures.
Yes, he's been not only does he help her with physical, you know, tasks like picking up objects and et cetera, but he is a calming influence, and he's also brought joy to their lives, her and Patrick's life.
Well, Sharon, I have to say, I you posted something on Facebook maybe this morning, and you said that this dog was the only one in the courtroom who had no idea about violence and about hatred. All this dog knew was about love.
I was thinking about that when I found out that Jess was going to be a witness today and that Rescue would be alongside of her. I was thinking about that. Rescue is the only one in that courtroom who has no concept of violence or hatred. And I was thinking about how comforting his presence would be to her and probably everybody else in that courtroom.
Well, I have to tell you, that is just a beautiful way, Sharon, of ending the show, just on that note. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Sharon, and for the work you do. Sharon wrote Weekends with Daisy. Michelle Piech, thank you for the work you do as a grief counselor at University of Pennsylvania. I think
Thanks so much for having us.
You and I have to have a little conversation about these dogs. We'll talk later. You can follow us at Twitter. Like I said, we're at Voices in the Fam. Please send us a picture. You can email us at whyy.org. Hey, check out what I'm up to these days at my webpage, drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Stanishevsky. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. We had help today from Keith Irwin, not to be confused with the Keith who was in prison with the service dog. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week.